Hello, this is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live. Today's guest is Joe Loya, and I'm going to just ask you to tell about your the title of your book, which will kind of explain part of who you are.
Yeah.
And I read the book actually after we met the first time you did this, mm-hmm. and I was struck, by the way, by the absolutely inescapable fact that you were such a good boy, derailed by behavior. You were you saw, and I think that's true of you now too. You just everything you do is to be your best mm-hmm. and your most uplifted. And let's just go to you now. So tell us the title of your book, and the issue that I really wanted to talk to you about is forgiveness. Okay. And when I said that, you already started right off I don't believe
in forgiveness.
So, Joe Loya, please tell the name of your book again, and it's so worth reading, people.
Oh, okay, so the title of my book is The Man Who Outgrew His Prison Cell, Confessions of a Bank Robber, because in the late 80s I robbed, for about 14 months I had a crime spree, and I robbed about 30 banks, went to prison for 7 years. While I was in prison, I changed my life, but midway through, I started writing, came out, and became a writer in 1996. Anyway, that's all in the book, and there's the other interview we talk about it. But what I want to talk about today...
Start with how you were raised and what your family was like and what your dad was like with you. And
so, the background of the story is I was raised in a very religious home. We were Mexicans in East Los Angeles, but we were Protestant Mexicans, whereas now it's a big phenomenon. More and more Latinos are Protestants. In those days, in the early 60s, it was a rarity. We are a very small population in East LA. Most of them Catholics, or Mexicans, were Catholics.
Yeah, that's what I think of.
But what's interesting is all the guys in junior high that I went to school with, I was the one Protestant. They were all Catholics. Now, you know, I go to meet them, my sixth grade friends, I go to meet them in LA to have Mexican food, you know, 40 years later. Mm-hmm. 40 years later, they're all Protestants. We can't meet on Sunday morning because they all go to church on Sunday morning.
What happened? What made that shift from
Big shift. You know, it's a Protestant movement has swept through.
Is it easier to be Protestant?
No. It's more American is what it is.
Oh, interesting.
More American in that it's related to economics. It's related to an Americanism. Anyway, but that's the thing is this, I was raised in a home in which my dad studied for the ministry, was for a minute, he was a preacher, had his own pulpit in East Los Angeles. I wanted to be, you know, at age four, I told my mother that I wanted to, you know, preach the gospel. I wanted to be a missionary. So I loved Jesus. I loved my community. And then eventually my mother passed away when I was nine. The stress on my dad, he was very young when I was born, both of them, 16, 17. The pressure on him was so intense that he eventually became kind of brutal and
you wouldn't say more than kind of brutal.
I would say, you know, it escalated to the point where at age 16, during a particularly vicious beating
that
of my brother and I, that I was enduring, we were enduring, in which, you know, at the hospital later, I would have a concussion and a broken bone. So it was bad. And I stabbed him in the neck and I tried to kill him. He survived. He never touched us again. But it awoke some violence in me that it would take another 16 years for me to, you said goodness derailed. I just submitted to the rage and let it just ruin my life. But
this wasn't one beating of your father's. This was a lifetime of
building
up
this. Sustained humiliations and sadism. And it was very bad. It was very bad. The book chronicles all that. Mm-hmm. But somewhere along the way, throughout my childhood, I recognized that I had a lot of animosity, a lot of anger, and after I stabbed my father, I kept trying to forgive him, but I had this rage towards my dad, horrible rage towards my dad, and the rage was so out of control that, you know, I had fantasies about continually injuring him when I came out of prison and that kind of stuff.
Mm. So that didn't do it, that one episode.
Forgiveness, that didn't get, stabbing my dad was not enough. In fact, the rage existed in such a way towards my father that as much as even before I lost my faith in God, I prayed and I asked for humility and I asked the power to forgive my father, the generosity, all of that. None of it came. None of it. None of my efforts to repent and love my dad, none of it happened. So I was in prison, and I started changing my life. And when I changed my life, one of the things that happened was I was in solitary confinement when I started thinking about changing my life. And I had a full year to think. I was in there for almost 2 years. I changed halfway through. And so I had a year of awakening, of to sit there and think, okay, if I'm going to be different, what is different? How do I do this? And one of the things that came is I was a very contemplative kid, little boy. And now I was thinking, you know what? I think I don't want to be a man of action anymore. I think I want to go back to being contemplative. I want to be thoughtful. I want to be a thinker like I had been raised to be, and which I thought was too effete, and it made me a sissy boy and a little nerdy bookish kid. I thought that was part of my vulnerability. So I wanted to get rid of the intelligence in me as a boy and become a man, a doer, you know? Now I was like, man, doing didn't really serve me well. Maybe I should become that little, you know, maybe take an edge off. The feet thing didn't look so bad at that point. So I thought, let me become a thinker. Let me do what I like to do. So I started thinking about my life. And in reflecting, there was a couple things that happened. I'm going to take you through it to get me to this epiphany I have. Mm-hmm. So when my mother passed away, there's three movements to get me there. When my mother passed away, was the first one, I remember thinking in prison, in my cell, when you tell somebody that your mother died, or like me, my kids would say, my mother died, they would say, oh, your mother must be very proud of you. I would say, oh, I'm sorry, but my mother's dead, actually. Immediately they would say, I'm sorry. Uh-huh. I'm sorry. And then you could feel them like back up. And it was weird. You know what it felt like to me? It felt like this weird emotional riptide where all of a sudden all this movement, power, something was accruing to me in that moment where I had something on them. I had to let them off the hook.
Oh,
they were like, okay. I'm sorry. And I felt like, wait, why are you apologizing to me? There's nothing, no apology required. You're giving me too much.
I thought you were going to say that what you had in saying that was it drove others away and isolated you further. No, you're not saying that.
No, what I'm saying was some chasm is created when you start apologizing to somebody.
Yeah.
You're now, like, it's kind of a toady-ish thing. And they're like, oh, I'm so funny. Like, oh, I'm sorry. And I didn't deserve anything in that. I didn't feel I deserved any of that in that moment. Because you haven't, there's no infraction.
Right.
You haven't done anything wrong. You're offering me, it's a weird thing when people tell you sorry. There's some emotional shift there.
Oh.
And I felt like I had to tell them, I finally was so uncomfortable with this. I came up with a tactic to say, no, don't worry, it wasn't your fault.
Exactly. Oh, that's what I would say, sure.
That's what became my thing.
Yes.
And then people would laugh, and then that moment would be gone. But I did not like being very sensitive to human interaction and the frequency of human contact. I knew in my cell, I was recognizing that something accrued to me that I was uncomfortable with.
Yes.
And it was some power. So, and I'll tell you, then that moved to the next movement, which was one time I abused that power. And it is power.
Easy,
and here's why.
Easy to do.
Here's why. I knew it was power. I didn't know it at the time growing up. I couldn't identify it. But then this moment, it became power. There was a bully in my church, and he was one of the college pastors. And I was high school pastor, and he was college age. I was high school, and I was a smart ass. And I knew he was a bully, and I didn't like him very much. And it was Jim Pearson, and we were in a group of high schoolers. Just to show you what kind of guy he was, he was insulting me in front of all these girls and boys, thinking he was superior. He's a college age guy. Why is he on my level, right? Trying to put me down. And he's supposed to be a church, like, you know, he's a religious leader. He's supposed to be a religious example. And so I knew I'm needling his ego. And finally, at one point, he just jokingly throws out, your mama. And I knew in front of all these people, I said, I played humble. I was like, I played wounded. I said, oh, my mother's dead. And when I said that, everyone looked at him like he was a schmuck. And I realized, oh, there is something that accrues. Look at how I'm using the power of this. And I used that to him, and he knew instantly. He said, you little... He knew what I had done.
Sure.
He knew it, and he started chasing me all over the room because I had used something precious as a weapon. And this is what I'm thinking, and this is what the next move was. I said, from that moment, I realized, you know what that reminds me of? It reminds me of forgiveness. when somebody comes to you and they say they forgive you, or they ask for your forgiveness.
In other words, they say, I'm sorry.
They say, you're sorry, or can I please forgive me? What happens is that same movement where all of a sudden what accrues to you is some moral stature. You are now in a position to offer something to them that is going to right the moral universe. And for me, in my cell, I knew that when I told him my mother's dead, that was vanity. I was using something that was legitimate, that's usually a pristine sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Something that's even like it is pristine. I was wounded by it. It was a major loss. But I was using it for vanity's sake. And in that moment, I swear to you, it was crystal clear all of a sudden to me. I looked at forgiveness unlike I looked at any other higher themes. I looked at that one as underwritten by vanity. And the reason I did that, let me unpack this. When somebody comes, this is the way, it was an image in my head. Somebody comes to you, and when you offer them forgiveness, you might as well be like in a knight sword and tapping them on the shoulder with a sword and saying, rise up. I have magnanimously offered you my forgiveness. The moral universe is right. And now we can move forward equally. If it's underwritten by inequality, and one person has the power to forgive, then that to me is not a greater theme. That to me is a generic power arrangement that you see all day long in everything that ruins the world because one person has more power than the other.
Oh, yes, I agree with that.
And when I thought of this, and I had been thinking about my ego a lot, I thought, oh, Joe, no wonder you can't forgive your dad. Because the thing that has been nurturing your wounds all your life is your ego. And now you are asking that thing whose only incentive to exist is to nurture the wound. You're now asking the ego to take personal offense at what has happened and now rise to the occasion and forgive the person.
So how do you do that? That's my question. Excuse me. How do you take that step when somebody has been so brutal and so not just humiliating and debilitating, like you say, but essentially unaware of who you are in order to be able to do that? How do you take that step to say, especially since you started out by saying, I don't really believe in forgiveness, how do you take that step to let him off the hook?
Here's the thing.
That is such an interesting...
I started thinking that for me, every time I had to come to forgiveness... Listen to that, even how I say that. Every time you cannot have forgiveness without I being central to it, because you have to start forgiving by saying, I forgive you. It's already problematic because the I is central to forgiveness. That means ego is central to forgiveness. Yeah. And that idea of the ego for me was I had to have taken it personally to begin with. If I am going to forgive you.
Oh, okay.
And
so there you go.
This was key for me.
There you go.
When I started looking at my father, I'm looking at myself and I'm reviewing my own life in that solitary confinement cell. And I realized I was a good kid like you. I was a sweetheart.
Mm-hmm.
And I went on to do some really monstrous things. I hurt people who loved me so much. So they were so delicate. And I was vicious to them, emotionally vicious. I was, I scarred people. I'm the reason people are in therapy for traumas. I get that. And it's sad and it's hurt. It's tough. But if I was going to move forward in my life, I needed to get to a point where I could have compassion for myself, or I was never going to change. I was just going to always hate myself and think that that's where I belonged. So I got to a point where I realized I'm not a monster. I did monstrous things, but I am not a monster. And if I'm willing to look at myself that way, I have to be willing to look at my dad that way. And frankly, when I took my vision to my dad after having this vision of myself, I said, wait a minute. I've been calling that man a monster all these years, but I'm now calling myself monstrous, not a monster, having done monstrous things. I can do the same thing to him. Okay. Let me examine him this way. Okay, let's
see. You talk about that in your book. And it was so touching. You talked about when you realized that he had some miseries in his life.
Yeah. the traumas of his life. He was brutalized as a kid.
Yes, and including
the death of my mother.
And yes, and losing the same woman you lost.
This is where I'm going to.
Yeah.
When I looked at my father, I saw that man was brutalized like me.
Right.
And he grew up to brutalize like me.
Yes.
I didn't brutalize children. I didn't have children, but I brutalized people. That man was humiliated because he was dark-skinned Mexican. They called him Negro, Blackie, basically. Gapped in his tooth, gap tooth boy, polio. The man was like, he had all these insecurities
that
growing
he's
up.
Carrying himself.
That
anyway.
He grew up and he had been beaten down as a kid. I know what that was like because I had gone through that. So I looked at my dad and said, oh, my God, man. You were like me. You were shipwrecked before you were born.
Yeah.
You did not have a chance. All that was modeled to you was miserable parenting. Now, the fortunate, weird thing was when
so
I looked at him and
man,
I said,
man to man, you were able to do that.
I was able to look at him and say, man, you know what? How else were you going to act? And you got me. He had me at 16. I knew that if I had kids when I was 26, I would have been a horrible parent to them. And you started 10 years before that.
What was your first conversation with them? How did you?
Okay, I'll get
that. Yes.
So, what the more important is that was most important is that when I started looking at how he behaved, I realized that me and the equation of the abuse was incidental. I didn't matter because he was always going to grow up, and you could have put 100 sons in front of him, and they're all going to be treated the same shitty way.
Mm-hmm.
They were because he did not know how to be anything else. And so, in that case, it didn't happen. The abuse didn't happen to me.
You got to the stage where you recognized that he didn't do something to you. He did it from him.
I couldn't say it any better.
Thank you.
What happened
That's
in that
was
moment was not about me. So when people say, how do you mean you didn't take it personally? He punched you, kicked you. That's it. I looked in and said, yeah, because it was happening with him. In fact, I had great compassion. You know what my compassion was? Oh, my God. What must your conscience be like today? You did that to me and my brother, and you loved us. I believe you loved us, and you acted against your conscience, and you did that. Oh, my God, you must be miserable. I looked at it like it had nothing. Like, when you hit me, you actually were kicking yourself in the soul. And when I could take myself out of the equation and realize that that wasn't about me, I didn't have a need to forgive him. It didn't happen to me. This
oh,
is what
okay.
I mean
so
by
that's what
it.
You mean,
I don't take it personally.
So you're not. That's what you say when you.
I don't believe in forgiveness
because
forgiveness comes from I.
That's
and
right.
If you don't take it personally, you don't have anything to forgive. Now the amazing thing about this is this. One. Now everything that I, all these structures that I had had before about hating him and this and that, they all crumbled. I didn't have to do any work after that because that one reframing, there was nothing anymore for me to attach to my father. It just crumbled.
Because
now,
I always had that question, you know, my attitude is always, just, you know, heaven spare me from the forgivers. Because there is an attitude, a superiority.
So
what you're
power.
Saying is exactly right.
It's a power arrangement. It's one of those higher things.
Understanding, not forgiving. Yes.
Called compassion.
Yes.
Compassion means you take yourself out of the equation.
Yes.
You see what happened to them. You observe what happened to them. You step away. You're an observer. And you accept that this is what happened to them. And you're not in. I'm not present at all. I'm looking at it. Now, I don't care if he kicked me, bit me, punched me. Yeah. Technically, you know, literally,
right.
I absorb punches and kicks and bites. But, like I said, my body is incidental in what really occurred in that moment. Now, here's what I want to say. I want to get to you. How did the conversation happen? I do get to a point in the book where I realize, and this is the wonderful thing, was that my dad shares with me how when my mom was getting these medications at the end of her, when she was almost dying, it was really horrible. She lost her memory and thought she was Elizabeth Taylor. The drugs were so horrible, she went mad. And when that happened, for 2 years, over two years, he struggled to keep the house together and everything together, but he knew one thing. She could recognize that he was stepping up and he was doing the right thing. When she could not recognize who he was, that broke his heart because the one thing that was keeping him going was the knowledge that she could see
yes.
he was loved her and he was doing everything. And when she got scared of him, one time she wanted to jump out of the car. When she had this moment, she didn't know who he was. And she thought she was being kidnapped. She tried to jump out of the car on the freeway on the way to dialysis. So when he saw she was afraid of him and didn't know him, that broke his heart. And on that conversation on the phone, when I walked away from the phone, I was in prison. I was talking to him. He was telling me about that. I realized that our wound was the same wound as the death of my mother.
Right.
And in that moment, my relation with my father collapsed into this thing that was now about all the likenesses, not the distinctions that everyone wants to make, the obvious distinctions, but all the likenesses, and mostly how we had both used anger to disguise a wound, and a wound that we both shared, which was the loss of my mother, the loss of his wife. And that solidified my view that if I want to have a relationship that's if I want to have congruency in my life, and I'm able to love people who I love and not have any block with all this emotional kind of sharpness and bitterness and rancor, I needed to find a way to love my dad and get out of the way.
And children want to love their parents.
Love that man. Yes. I love him to death. We have dim sum. Every time I'm around there, I dig that man. I love him to death. So that's what people ask me. How did you forgive your dad? Clearly you forgave your dad.
That's very clear how you
and
forgave
I said,
him.
I didn't forgive him. I didn't forgive him.
Yes.
I did not forgive him. Yeah. I developed compassion for him and never had the need to forgive him because I never took it personally. Now, you need to know, my boy Frank McCourt agreed with me on this one. I gave a talk about this at the Sun Valley Writers Conference, and he came up to me. This is where we became friends. He came up to me, hugged it out, right in the line of all these people. It was kind of humbling. There's a line of people to greet me.
I mean,
and
who could not agree with this? It's so clear and so...
People want to really hold on to... You'd be surprised how many people want to hold on to the concept of forgiveness. Because the eye.
Yes, yes.
I've had people...
Because it makes them feel the stronger.
I guess so. But I had a person the other day. He's like, man, I talked about you in therapy today. I said, what? Why? He says, because you wrote a post about how much you love your dad and how close you are to your dad. He said, and I talked about how much I hate my dad. And my dad's dead. I was like, wow. He said, I can't forgive him. And he's dead. I said, well, you know what? That's why. And I ran this all down him. And you know what he said? I've never had it seen that way. Now I can see light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, that's why it's so important that you're talking about this.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, that's my thing about forgiveness. I don't believe in forgiveness.
Yes.
I think that if you don't take it personally, you don't have to forgive someone. If you have compassion for them, it takes the eye out of it. You get to observe what they did and what happened to you in that contact with them ends up being incidental.
And you know, oddly enough, I'm guessing that along with that comes at some point when you say you stabbed him and you tried to kill him, I'm guessing you just wanted him to stop doing what he was doing.
No, he actually wanted. I was trying to kill him.
Oh, you really did want to.
I understood, and in my 16-year-old mind,
for your safety?
I understood that I had one shot.
Right.
Because as an abused kid, one thing you think is that they are monsters. Remember, he'd been beating me forever as long as I was a kid. And even after I stabbed him and he fell to the ground and he screamed out, you killed me. I ran so fast out of that house because I thought he was going to pull it out of his neck and he was going to chase me and kill me.
Oh, my goodness.
That's how scared you are. So when I tried to stab him in the neck, the intent was if I need to slay Goliath. And a neck shot, I thought, was a kill shot.
Yeah.
And I went to the neck, and it didn't kill him. It barely missed the back of his spine. I got him in the back of the neck because he moved away. Mm-hmm. But I was trying. I was trying to kill him because I did not want. And listen, we went to McLaren Hall, this place where, you know, it's a foster care space where they you wait until you can get a foster home. Mm-hmm. The walls were like 25 feet high, and every day when I came out there, I would look around because I thought this man would scale the walls and get me. I was so. That's why it wasn't just to try and stop stabbing him. It wasn't just to try and stop him. You don't think they're giants, man. In your imagination, they are giants. I was scared to death. And then he ended up changing. It humbled him. And I think that's what I was writing the other day in this post, in my Facebook post, that he taught me how to be humble. He worked hard, and he ran through all these hoops. Jumped through all these hoops to get us back.
How did he teach? Oh, yes.
He jumped through all these hoops.
Yes.
And I was horrible my senior year when I came back to the house, my senior year after foster care. I knew we had social workers on our side, people visiting the home. And my dad was working hard. And I was using my power that I now had with all this, you know, county backup behind me, police and social workers and whatever. And the court was ready to take us back and on. I was so mean to him. I was very cruel. I was very cruel, and he just submitted to it all because he knew this is what he had to do. And he was very clear to he. When, one of the things that shocked me at one of our first visits when he came to visit us at the foster home, so much makes you want to cry thinking about it. He said, "I was wrong because the Bible says not to exasperate your children. I clearly exasperated you."
So he was able to say he was wrong, even though
he was able to say not only he was wrong, but in his own belief system, he sincerely felt that he had violated, his compact with God and his beliefs has acted against his conscience. And he didn't act against his conscience like that ever again. And in fact, I've gotten to know him all these years over the years and see that all the decencies in him,
there must have been plenty of those also.
He was so much beyond, he went beyond what it was parented to him. He made the same mistakes his parents made. But you know what? He made these choices that they never could have made. And I don't know where they come from. People meet me and they're like, "Oh my God, you made such a big dramatic change." And I said, "I'm Joe Loya of Second Intensity. My dad's Joe Loya too. I'm Joe Loya Jr." That man went from a gang when he was a kid, a little gang member, to studying classical Greek and Hebrew philosophy at UCLA.
So he made a small improvement.
He made some innovations.
From where he was raised. And then you've been able to take it the rest of the way.
He made some. I was listening to classical music as a kid. I was learning Greek and Hebrew. Mm-hmm. And I was reading the classics in ninth grade. He gave me something that he never had.
Oh, okay. So now I have a question for you because, I am basically about putting these things in letters and sending
them. I haven't done that yet.
Okay.
I'm embarrassed to say because that was a great idea you gave me last time.
Okay. So I'm going to give you the same idea this time. Don't be embarrassed because life is busy. But at some point, maybe you will sit down and just say the love letter would be, "Thank you for all the good I got from you," and then just list it because people aren't mind readers.
No, I know.
You can say you're so special and that doesn't mean squat.
I'm very detailed when I talk to him.
I know, yeah.
And he's very quiet when he hits me. He loves me. It's amazing. Of course he would. You're brilliant.
I need to do it. I need to give it to him. I'm going to tell you, when he dies, that's what you're going to find in his pocket, in his hand, or on the bedside table. I see that all the time. How much those letters mean. For a lifetime. Oh, good. Okay, I'm glad you still remember that.
Of course.
Because you are a writer. And you are a person who expresses yourself so easily.
Thank you.
And so honestly and so intelligently that anything, and I know you write and you write and you write, but handwriting is king.
No, handwriting is king.
I don't know what you're
saying. Handwriting is boss.
And nobody has yours. Mm. Nobody has yours.
No.
Dear, thank you so much for explaining this.
I'm glad. You got it.
Yes. Okay. And I had, I was on the borders of wondering if you meant this and if you meant that, because I have my own feelings about those who, the phrase, "I forgive you," just makes me want to smack someone, because
I'm so glad we recognize that, yeah.
Okay, thank you, dear. Well, until next time, this is Janet Gallen and
Joe Loya
saying goodbye. And please, if you have not done yourself the favor, The Man Who Outgrew His Prison Cell by Joe Loya, it is so interesting and so gripping, and not just for the bank robber, obviously, aspect of it, and not just for the brutality aspect of it, and not just for the horrible sadness of a 9-year-old watching his mother die. All of that is horrible. But for the joy of seeing what is inside this man and always was. And I have a question. I know we don't have much time. Mm-hmm. But don't you think that you are that you were always that kind of person helped you get to this forgiveness more?
What kind of person?
The kind of person who was thoughtful and a really good soul. In other words, not everybody can do this.
I'm going to tell you, I'm my dad.
Yeah, good.
My dad is that guy.
Yeah.
He's a reasonable person, and he likes to give people benefit of the doubts.
Because you're a truly nice human being.
I'm like my mom and my dad. Yeah, they are sweet people.
That's
good
true.
People.
That's true of everybody. We're like our moms and our dads.
And I have good people. Yeah. I mean, he acted against his conscience in dramatic ways and episodically, but I got a lot of good parenting and love.
And you know what? And that you made that clear too. The wrestling hellos. So every one of life's moments has within it the seeds of a love letter to somebody, and it is your time, your chance to document your own life in your own hand. So just do it and have a good time.
Yay.
Thank you and goodbye.
Bye.